Good evening. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Jim Coleman. I'm the Dean of the College of Humanities and Sciences, and as your program states, I was assigned to give opening remarks. And I have to admit that that is a frightening and challenging task. Frightening, you might ask? How so? Simply after I make it through these opening remarks, you'll be treated to some of the most gifted writers in the world, channeling Claudio's profound, emotionally powerful, and mesmerizing poems. Poems in which the English language was an artistic palette from which Claudia painstakingly chose each word and painted them on her canvas in exactly the right place at the right time, producing a one-of-a-kind integrated work of invaluable art with extraordinary beauty, complexity, and depth. I feel like I'm an amateur kazoo player asked to warm up the audience for the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. So please don't boo me off the stage. But besides from being frightening, the task is challenging. Challenging in the sense that I probably, like most of you, am still grieving. Particularly grieving that there was so much more about Claudia that I wanted to know, so many more students she wanted to teach, and there's just so much more poetry to write. Yet I truly want to celebrate because I feel so lucky that I got to know Claudia just a little bit. Her vast curiosity and intellect, her wry and grounded humor, her profound devotion to her work and her students, and her positive personality. I am so extraordinarily happy that she joined us here at VCU and in Richmond, and I savored every minute I could to say she was on the Humanities and Sciences faculty. So in preparing these remarks, and I guess like all bad kazoo players who open for the Vienna Philharmonic, I dreamed of having something surprising in my opening act to distract you. I was dreaming that I might have something to capture the audience's attention and put them in the celebratory mood for tonight's main event. And I'm happy to report that my dream came true. As many of you know, Claudia's husband, Kent Ippolito, suggested that those of you who wish to celebrate Claudia's life might make a donation to VCU to support the creative writing program and its students through a fund in Claudia's name. I am pleased to tell you tonight that we have received an overwhelming degree of support in the Claudia Emerson Fund. So much so that I can tell you that Claudia's passion and devotion for teaching and creative writing will live on for the foreseeable future. Because of the outpouring of support, we will be able to endow a scholarship in Claudia's name. And so the Claudia Emerson Scholarship will be given each year to at least one student in the creative writing program who focuses in poetry or in creative nonfiction. I feel so happy that her legacy will live on here at VCU and that the Claudia Emerson Fund will support the growth of generations of writers to come. Hers is definitely a life to be celebrated. So with that, let's get on with the program, and thank you all so much for being here. And it is really great that we have a scholarship fund in our name, isn't it? I mean, yes. It's spectacular. So now we're going to have readings of a selection of poems by Claudia, and starting will be Amanda Bosch with Entrance.
As many others do here tonight, I feel deeply fortunate to have met Claudia and to have had the opportunity to get to know her better during her time in Richmond. She was and continues to be a positive force and a role model in my life. Not just as a poet and mentor, though an endlessly impressive and devoted poet and mentor she was, but as a woman. More specifically, as a woman who spoke her mind bravely, even when it was a risk or a challenge to do so. And by being that kind of woman, she encouraged other women around her to not be afraid of using their voices either. And so I am pleased to use my voice to honor Claudia tonight. I chose to read the poem Entrance from her most recent collection, The Opposite House, because of how it reminds me of both her wonderfully wicked sense of humor and her compassion. A couple of years ago, at a reading of hers, she described the woman in this poem, one of her mother's friends, by saying, through a little laughter, "I couldn't help but write about her because it's not funny. I know it's not funny. But towards the end of this woman's life, she would be convinced that she was already dead. So she would start calling people up on the phone to see if she could get anyone to convince her that she wasn't." Entrance. One. Some evenings, her own house convinces her she is already dead. photographs, framed portals into which she sometimes falls awake in another room. The phone is silent in its cradle, food tasteless, even salt, dumb grains of glass. She calls someone who does answer, but a voice cannot convince her otherwise. The self dead who called another woman's husband with an innocent question, the excuse to hear his voice. The self who would have had a cigarette about now, the lighter in a drawer, here somewhere, her initials engraved, a flourish of cursive. She craved the sound of the thumb wheels scrape against flint, small flame, that first long drag, the practiced rings of smoke she formed with a mouth painted to disappear behind them. The glass of driest sherry cannot persuade her, though she drinks it anyway. Her hair, her fingernails, her nakedness against the naked floor, the body unbathed for days, some days not enough. Two, too small to see the upper nest. She feels the sleeve of its body well-muscled with eggs. She knows her mother's fury will be not only at the eggs lost, but at the setting egg devoured also, a doorknob of oblong crazed porcelain meant to trick the hens into laying. She would have tried to kill the snake anyway, but now has to be more certain of it. Lifting out the stuporous body and quickly, deftly severing the head, offensive mouth with a paring knife, the way she has been taught. She massages out a fluid, wasteful braid of whites and yolks, shell-specked. What would have been more than enough, she thinks, for a pound cake, before the knob at last falls with a thud, like anything but an egg, to the ground. Small, insistent entrance to another house, any house, a painted door, and, all to herself, one full room.
I'm so grateful to be able to be here to celebrate Claudia, someone who came to mean so much to me in such a short amount of time. It's amazing to think about how quickly someone can ingrain themselves in your being. Often, for almost no reason at all, the summer days I spent with her on the porch or in her treehouse kind of come back to me. The way she would turn to laugh, you know, at a phrase or an observation she'd made, or you just got the sense that you were with somebody who was immensely present, remarkably so. And just the humor she had. The reason I chose this poem called Romantic Fever is because I think it captures that humor in such a real way. And with the seriousness that lays under it. Romantic Fever. I fought the lost summer of 58 from the narrow sun porch bed. Rheumatic fever clenched a fist in every joint. My skin seared white hot sheets my mother washed every day and hung on the line like sails swollen pointlessly against anything anchored this deep. She plugged in the zenith for me, rock and roll melted in morphine. Jerry Lee's new release, Great Balls of Fire, played every hour to unborn irony. By September, pale legs like pain-hollowed stems and wrists as weak as oak leaves, I was fragile but redeemed, capable of growth, sent back to school where I swayed by the lockers, watched as the viral rumor caught and spread. She's been in bed with romantic fever. That night I lay harbored in the darkness, watching the doomed fireflies rise. Easier to believe the stars had fallen, crippling in the trees. In the damp grass, one lay flat on its back, coughing up light. Thank you.
The bat. We didn't know what woke us, just something moving, lighter than our breathing. The world bound by an icy ligature, our house was to the bat a hollow, warmer cavity that now it could not leave. I screamed for you to do something, so you killed it with the broom. I heard you curse as you swept the air. I wanted you to do it until you did. I've never forgiven you.
Like Justin said, I didn't know Claudia that long either, but it's kind of incredible how much of an impression I think she made after having known her only for a few months. And I think this only speaks to really kind of how incredible and beautiful of a person that she was. I'm writing my thesis right now, and I can remember one of the meetings that I had with her in August or something around then, and she looked at me and she said, "Christian, I think you're managing and writing about your anger really well." And she said, "I don't know how you're doing that, but you're really doing it well." And the funny thing was, I don't think I'd ever told her, and I wish I could, but I think it was because I had been reading her first book, actually. And so I think of that, and that's why I wanted to read this poem, Cleaning the Graves. Certainly not one of her more uplifting ones, but one of the more important ones to me. Cleaning the Graves. The once a year we come here is as close as my mother comes to mourning. These graves are all she has left of land she hated losing. And I am descended from this loss. Her mother, a woman who trapped snowbirds for pot pie, who let hens nest in the kitchen in freezing weather so they would lay better, who could wring their heads from their bodies in one motion, who could wrestle down a calf. "Your blood is that cold," she tells me, "but you don't know it yet. Never had hard times. Hard times could never kill one of us." The old lie. I know she will always see her mother in that hated cotton coat, walking 4 deep white miles to work. A figure never diminishing from sight. That mother won't succumb to something so gentle as decay. Not ashes, not dust. Never was and won't be, and neither will mine. Her blood is that cold. Still, all my life I have asked after her happiness as if it were closer kin. I watch her wrestle away from the grave the fallen white rib of a sycamore. The smile meant for me is cast, a shadow, past me. "Are you happy?" I have asked her, asking her to lie.
My friendship with Claudia lasted so long that I don't like to think of how many years it lasted. And it seemed to be from the very first instant I ever met her as natural as rain or sunshine. It was just automatic. It was honest and fun from the start and to the end. At first, I thought I might read the poem Stringed Instrument Collection from her wonderful late wife, because part of my friendship with Claudia has always been my friendship with Kent. And we're both musicians, and both of us are privileged to own instruments that will outlive us. And that's what that poem is about. But when Claudia came here to VCU, she was setting herself a challenge. She set herself a challenge as a teacher, as a person, and as a writer. And of course, it's that last one that's very important to me to have witnessed. I knew what she was up to, and I witnessed the changes that she made in her work. She was courageous in her living, and she was courageous in her writing. And she is an example to us all. This is a poem that I think exemplifies that courage that she undertook in the newer stage of her writing. It's a longer poem. This is written in a way to honor another writer, Emma Bell Miles, who, like Claudia, was an Appalachian writer. Emma Bell Miles lived from 1879 to 1919. She was an essayist, a poet, and a naturalist who lived in Signal Mountain, Tennessee. I can imagine there are all sorts of ways with which Claudia identified with her. And this poem is called Bird Ephemera. The canned fruit bursts. It is frozen solid, so long, the sound is quieter than it ought to be, quiet as the birdless tree of ice that bore the peaches. There is no mess, there ought to be. I hear of worse, a woman bedridden, her legs, her feet freeze, blacken, a quiet wither. This begins as penciled observation, sometimes words, a bird call heard, sometimes an outline, eye draft, a drawing in greater detail, if an hour opens its frozen gate, map of the bird, primaries, coverts, secondaries, lore. The pages begin to fill. I carry it everywhere, in an apron pocket, to the field, the spring, a gully, the base of a tree, a map, a chart, anatomy, Tarsus. I think of this, eye stripe, when he is on me. In this, the record of what winters over, survives with us, thrasher, hermit thrush, what leaves. What leaves the field is the same here as what leaves the eye. If I have this evidence of a bird recorded, nuthatch, waxwing, there is evidence of me, what I don't say. Here is not, and all is not what it seems. Muscle memory of fire and iron-laden water. The new baby, much like any other, the confinement the same, same trunk, lid, its cradle. The man, the way he worries a stump out of the ground, the way he rocks it, cradling loose tooth, the way he fails, the same, gives up, folds his hands in his lap for now. The spine goes brittle, the glue turns to sand, sprig of fern dried in the pages, brittle comb, fragile teeth, sky slight shadow remains the failing of all color. A shadow is the same as a cave. My twin brother died before I drew a breath. I have to cut one of my dresses into two for the girls. I had expected the one to die before winter, not to learn to tell one apart from the other. I cannot bear another child, another winter, another year, another unimaginable. The enemies of the bird, man, the elements, accident, other anomalies, birds of prey, snakes, my own the same. The butcher bird impales smaller birds, snakes and moles, impales them on barbed wire and thorns, the weapon of this world. A tent, consumptive, on the grounds of the hospital, a lung collapsing, collapsing light, a pole sunk straight through the middle of the air. The neighbor's baby dies again. A day drags its length. A cowbell drags its sound. No, it is wind, the hem of this dress dragging the ground. Miscarriage, I will call it. Suicide. I drank what I had heard, a tincture, tansy cohosh, pennyroyal, primrose, mistletoe, what had hung from a lintel at Christmas time, and still it clung, only to die at its birth, limp infant, dead word on a pillow slip, stained with it, a wren in the tent. It enters easy as air moving, easy as grief. It eats from my hand. It mistakes my hair for the stuff of a nest, lichen from a boulder, spider's web, hornet's nest, for the nest itself. I wave it away. It returns, unafraid, as though I am not altogether me. Something made from the elsewhere, a thing to dissemble. On the water shelf by the bucket, a nest lined with lichen, stolen, remolded. In it, a shelve, halved, blue, thimble, needleless eye. The blind horse we can afford, the blindness we afford, all that doesn't need to see this staggering passage of ground. Lace, a remnant of curtain for a bookmark, a text of bird and vine saved for this recollection of a window, a warbled pane of glass. Now, this slip of a passage. A child lives long enough to slip fixed into a name, scarlet fever closing it, closing the throat, he tells me, some other house. I'm going to go to some other house. What other house has he ever been to? His brow smoothed, then some other hand smoothing it. The kittens die, all, and still she looks for them, calls, swollen for them. She is not this, she is cat, animal, all, whose young survive her, have long forgotten her. When she bellies under the house to die, having forgotten them all summer, the burning of sedge grass, the cough, the wind weaving a shroud, melancholia, the moss on the stones in the spring house, burning. I turn the children out naked into the woods, the human understory, thicket of switches. I am never more than 3 meals from the nothing I tell them there is. I finish the last biscuit, watch it disappear with them. This a hymn of shadow, it is here. My own translation. Hurry, hurry. A lexicon finished betrothal was ever this. The weld, are you weary? The rent illusion, that hour, this one, when the thrush can insist, it is not real. And will, it is not real. Barred owls, unseen, caterwaul, vesper sparrows, chimney swifts, crisscross, intricate etching of afterimage, their delight in emptying the sky, emptying the eye, mine in the dooryard, the swept, it is not real, elegance of a finished thing.
It wasn't until I started to look for a poem to read tonight that I realized how many winged things there are in Claudia's poems. I think maybe every poem has had one of them so far. It may be that they all have them in one way or another. So I would say this, for someone who so loved a set of wings, she was one of the most earthiest people I've ever met. And that was one of the things that I admired the most about her, was her incredible groundedness. Sometimes, and I think the poem that Greg just read points towards that, the world can seem overwhelming and it can seem as though there are so many troubles and so many people that need our help, that there's nothing that we can do. And we feel a great sense of a lack of effectiveness in the face of that and can sometimes choose to do nothing at all. But as you've heard the students who've been up here speaking, that was just not Claudia's way. It wasn't her belief. She did a tremendous amount of good. She changed lives in the little bit of time that she was here with us. And so I chose this poem because I thought that it pointed very much to this incredible belief that she had in a kind of practical beneficence. It's called The Practice Cage. I was taking my routine run, the same 3 miles just past daybreak on the jogging trail that encircled the playing fields, the home of the Fighting Eagles. I'd run that course so many times I imagined myself a goat circling the invisible stake of the baseball diamond's off-season desolation, scoreboard blank before the lightning sky. Behind the stands, I heard first the dozen crows that crowded around a practice batting cage, a metal-framed, room-sized rectangle, its sides and ceiling made of thick, heavy net. Then I saw the cause of the complaint, a red-tailed hawk on the ground inside. I'd spent most of my life in the country before moving to this city. I'd seen hundreds of hawks, but what I knew of them was distant patience, or an extreme diving speed, or death. I walked toward the cage and the crows rose, scattered. The hawk flew up into the corner, struggled there, twisting upside down as though tearing this other sky with his talons, before going limp, still turned, wings splayed outward. Where I expected tension, fury, I saw instead the taming of despair. His eyes resigned to this, to me, softened somehow as though with forgiveness. I could see where he'd flown in. One edge of the netting gapped. So I worked the knots to raise the hem higher while the bird hung, indifferent to my effort. So motionless, I was convinced he was injured by the struggle. But when I spoke, urged him, tugged at the net below, he seamlessly let go from that stillness, dropped down, and righted himself into flight, finding at once the wider gap, and was, with no wing beat at all, gone, clearing the lip of the stadium to disappear into the turning stand of poplars bordering the fields. I began my run again then, elated by the sound of my own breathing, by my feet striking the ground beneath me, by knowing I would round that same turn time after time and see again in that familiar emptiness something we had revised, an absence finished.
I'd like to thank VCU and the English department for hosting this tonight, and also David Wojohn for, wherever you're seated, for bringing us together and organizing it. I'm trying to think about what to say tonight, and I couldn't help but think about friendships and how sweet the friendships are that come sometimes late in life, after middle age, and that was the kind of friendship that Claudia and I enjoyed. They're gorgeous and complicated because there's just so much that needs to be discussed. Everything that's happened and everything that's going to happen. And I feel like my friendship with Claudia was very rich and very sweet from the moment that we met. If you knew Claudia, you'd know that a lot of conversations with her might include this sentence. She'd say, "I know it's none of my business, but, and you'd know that what was gonna follow could be anything from something she was worried about or that you were worried about, your homework, a student, a bit of gossip, a poem underway, whatever. And she always had an opinion. She always had advice, premonitions, warnings. It was very exciting to be Claudia's friend. So I like to remember that about her all of the time. The poem that I'm gonna read tonight is from Claudia's second book, Pinion, which is a book-length poem, basically. It's set on a tobacco farm at the beginning of the last century. Like a lot of what you've heard tonight, psychological complexity was one of the things that fascinated Claudia, and I think that she wrote particularly well. And so I think this poem reflects that kind of work among her many, many wonderful poems. So this poem is called The Admirer. September 1926, clear. He had before come courting with pecans or peaches, berries. I had those times been able to thank him with one of my pies and be done with him. For this, though, he would want supper, to sit at the table with me after supper. For this, I reckoned, he had spent most of the morning emptying the sky of its plenty. The doves spilled from burlap in iridescent disarray, 3 dozen at least, a shimmering bouquet. And so the afternoon was for me defined. The hour deepened, the mound of feathers blue-gray, plucked in porch dusk, and the wind, disinterested, would once in a while stir them. I knew they were easy to bring down over a field where they would fall into the tangled grasses and go on flying against what had been wind. Easy, as this was not. Feet, gut, heart, the smooth brow with eyes open like garnets glowing. I cut and tossed over and over what was in the end useless onto the feathers, a last and bloody bed, or to the cats who growled and circled me to keep the peace. A dove would amount to, at best, a half dozen mouthfuls, the dark breast tender but gristled with shot, black seed. I threw a whole bird to the nursing cat and wondered whether the white kitten had opened its eyes. If they were blue, it would be deaf, I had been told, and told I could not let it live. I would see about that. Mother called down, "How are they coming?" "More work than they're worth," I answered her, "for such a little meat." Even with the birds still baking, yet to be eaten, with still the biscuits to stir up and gravy yet to make from the meager fat, with a straight hour to pass before he would lean back from the table to pick his teeth and sigh. I had decided he should have left with the doves, their beloved sky, for I would not be one.
I met Claudia about 5 years ago. A former teacher of mine invited me up to JMU to hear her read. And it's not too often that we get to meet our heroes. I think oftentimes we sometimes develop these personas in our imagination that they can't quite live up to. And Claudia far and surpassed that persona that I had imagined. And in the time that I got to know her, continued to outdo herself as one of the kindest, most honest, fiercest, most generous people that I've gotten to know. I picked this poem because at that reading, I don't know if it was on that trip or a previous trip, she had seen the inciting incident of the poem, but she read it when it was then a very new poem and shared it with us. So it's a personal favorite of mine. Late April house fire along Interstate 81. I had wondered for some time about its source. The smoke, a fixed roiling column visible for miles, unchanged by the wind that had all day blown across the road with pollen and bees, a fine spring snow, salting fields newly greening, the red buds livid beneath it. By the time I came upon it, fire was indivisible part of the two-story wood frame farmhouse, still itself completely whole, composed, white clapboard, porch and roof, front door, window frames, glass panes intact. The chimneys that would survive, calm inside the flame's straight rush, contained bright rising in ravishment. I knew this was nothing like the worst resolve of another hour when the backward gravity of fire would have relented to the old habit of collapse, the sift of slow ash down on all that does not burn, hinges, latches, doorknobs, keys still stuck in the locks, the wind passing through windowless air. But this was anguish, not yet grief. And so I slowed but did not stop to watch someone else's tragedy burn past this brief, nearly beautiful suspension that changes nothing.
It's just been a joy for me to hear Claudia's students talk about Claudia the way her students always did. I missed out on that end part of her teaching, and I just wish I could have sat in on some of those classes with you all, because I know that's what she's like and what kind of teaching she did and what warmth and candor that she brought to everything she did. I have many memories of her from an earlier period, so it's kind of fitting that we're all together, those who were late friends and late students, and my memories of some of her earlier days. She and I would run into each other a lot in the Pobiz, as I'm sure you all knew. And every time she was just like my best friend. We would always have fun together. And she always had a little gossip from the field. She told a wonderful story about being at the Palm Beach poetry affair that she had attended, and that the poet in the classroom next to her where complained to her about all the laughter, the loud laughter coming from her classroom. He literally complained. He said, "I just can't get on with my class." And so she went into her class and said, "Come on, class, we're moving." So that was just, I just ran into it, something we were doing together, and I said, "How was the Palm Beach affair?" And she said, "Let me tell you that I just won't even say another word except his first name was C.K. Anyway, I would pick up stories like that all the time in our long friendship. And, oh, there's C.K. Anyway, a great poet, but didn't like laughter. This poem is from her first book, Pharaoh, Pharaoh. And I just love the fact that in this poem, you hear so many Claudia-isms, so many images, so many way of expressing something from nature. And I'm just going to say right now to look for the line, the varicose wake of a mole heaves. Now, if you don't understand that line, good, because you don't have mole problem in your yard. But can you, what a line, the varicose, you know, like the veins, wake of a mole heaves as, and then you'll hear the rest of it. But I just thought that one line, there are very few people who would understand that. And yet it is so precise. Okay, here's the whole poem, all Claudia, very early Claudia in the late 90s. Auction, maybe earlier than that, that's when it was published. Auction. Some things bring nothing. Later, there will be a bonfire of palm-worn plow handles. But a doll, pallid, china hands fractured, brings $15. His bed they have hauled out, the covers still on it, an old man's nest of tangled flannel. I think he had no daughters to know what must not be sold. His late wife's dressing table gives up its confused vanities. Snaggletooth combs, the warbled wire of hairpins, a lipstick, a faint layer of blush over all. The sun-shocked mirrors denies this face, waves my hair, widens my eyes until I cannot see the resemblance. Is this how she saw herself? And over the fields, should the fields falling away from the house, steep with distortion, under her crushed narcissus, the varicose wake of a mole heaves as if the vagrant dead grow bolder, rise, thick palms bared for this shallow, movable darkness.
Hi, I'm Linda Fleet Perry. I feel extremely lucky and grateful that my time in VCU's MFA program coincided with Claudia's time here. I was acquainted with Claudia, but came to know her through my work as a student representative of her search committee. And because we shared a close mutual friend, we became friends after she and Kent moved to Richmond. She was extraordinarily generous to me, as she was to all her students and colleagues and friends, coming to my house and sharing her teaching philosophy and strategies, agreeing to serve on my thesis committee, and even after she was very sick last summer, making a point of attending my mother's memorial. Claudia always did the right thing. She showed up. It was part of her character. I know she hated to leave us, especially Kent. She would have been at every one of her students' thesis readings this spring with bells on. I admire the way Claudia followed her obsessions, wherever they led her, how she created a life that supported her art, how she managed to stay down to earth, authentic, and thoughtful of others, even while achieving such acclaim for her poems. She was a kind of person who was not only always prepared and on time, but early. I would meet her on campus for a bag lunch or at a neighborhood coffee shop to discuss thesis poems. And I always tried to arrive before she did so I wouldn't keep her waiting. Even if I was early, Claudia was there first. That's the way my mother raised me, she told me. And more than likely, she'd be writing in her notebook when I walked in. She was always writing. I also admire how close she was to Kent. She was devoted to him. In my last visit with her, Kent made a little fire in the fireplace and gracefully withdrew. And Claudia sat and talked with me. As usual, not so much about her illness, although she was honest about her anxiety and fear. Instead, she wanted to know how her students were doing, what was going on in his apartment, and she was worried about Kent. Claudia and Kent brought laughter and genuine fun with them, upending the notion of anything stuffy about a literary community. They shared living room music jams, games of croquet with vintage mallets around the fire pit, poetry workshops and picnics in the treehouse, and they shared their big, generous hearts. Common house sparrows at JFK's International Terminal. They survive in factories, warehouses, even coal mines. Some were, after all, shipborne. And so that they are here should not surprise their small host a constant nervousness, accepted, ignored, around and about the food court's balcony, just above security. From their perch, a skeletal sculpture of abstracted aluminum and guy wire. They seek breadcrumbs, grains of rice, of salt and sugar strewn beneath tables and chairs, their survival dependent on redundant carelessness. Perhaps they are not captive here and meant to enter through an air vent or skylight, or perhaps they succumb to curiosity and the happenstance of the automatic door's slow revolve to become the only natives of this place, everyone else transient, destinations ticketed, mirage-like. They bask in what light manages to fall through soot-fogged windows, or bathe in the slough of never-ending passage, arrivals and departures in perfected symmetry, this windless, rainless asylum sky enough.
A couple of years ago, I joined the staff of the Suwannee Writers Conference, and I was pretty nervous. It was my first day, and it was the day when only the staff and the faculty were there. And I was walking alone across a parking lot on the campus at the University of the South. And I see someone speeding by on a bicycle. And I realized it was Claudia. And I said, "Hello, Claudia," and I waved at her, but she didn't say anything back at first. She sort of sped up over the hill and out of my sight. Then came all the way back, on her, circled me a few times, asked me how my day was going. And after that, I was much less nervous. And I also wanted to do my job really well then. And something about her energy imbued that. And she did that with everything. Anytime I read her poems, she made me want to write poems. Anytime that we talked about teaching, I wanted to go back into the classroom and teach again. And over the last few weeks, I've been working in a letterpress class, and I got to make a broadside of one of her poems. And in that, it was almost like getting to hang out with her again and to know the words so deeply. The poem I did for the broadside is this following poem called I, and I picked it partly, one, because the title being I sort of gestured to the letter I, and this idea of the materiality of language. But it also, and it was also shorter, so since I wasn't so good at setting movable type, I thought that would work well. But it also gave me the challenge of doing things like italics and indentions and white space and sort of gesturing towards even silence, which the poem sort of gets at. I. The brain seizes on it, familiar beginning of what he means to say. The rest of the sentence, urgently close, utterly lost. The body of something dissevered from its head. So whirring the hem of his pajama jacket like a rosary between forefinger and thumb, he tries again and again, repeating the long, flat I, a needle deepening in the groove, until his voice registers something beyond grief, disbelief. The word having returned to sound, oblivious elegy, that pure vowel. Thank you.
Jubilation. The rear wall of her house, all glass. The garden defined the living room with its small stand of paper birches, a narrow stream, the hillside that confined it, all quick with flight and shadows of flight. Cardinals, thrushes, juncos, doves, sometimes a heron, a hawk. She said the birds must believe, if belief applied in such, that the mirrored trees were ahead when they flew into the reflection that was her house, unaware that what killed or stunned was more than glass, the misdirected flight we all take sometimes into the place just left behind. And when she found a bird tangled in ivy, she put it in a shoebox, in a closet. There, sometimes, it would return to itself. The enclosed hour she had come to imagine, it perceived only as a healing fugue of darkness, another night that had indeed passed, not so much unlike all the others. The lid removed, then not to death, but to sudden afternoon and the briefest moment of stillness before the rush of lifting up and out, a quickening reabsorbed at once into the oblivion of a world having gone on, bright and raucous without it, no worse for the absence perhaps. But surely that was jubilation she heard in the cicada's immediate flourish of sound, as though the hour itself had been restored with the bird it had moved through.
This short poem shows, I think, Claudia's clear-sighted intelligence, her great generosity, her intense interest in science, and her love of teaching. Also, this amazing ending to this poem, in it, Claudia shows, as she does so often, that she is a down-to-earth visionary. It's called Biology Lesson. It was published in Shenandoah Magazine and then later in her book, Figure Studies. Biology Lesson. It seems impossible that there could be any ancestral link between the turtle, plodding, benevolent creature they keep in the glass terrarium, and any bird. But once the teacher suggests it, they begin to see in the blunt beak stained with mulberry juice, the low brow, eyes, the scales on its legs, certain, if at first, strained resemblance. Then, even in its poor posture, they are convinced of another sky into which it withdraws, not to become invisible, but to soar fearless inside itself, small dome of safe, starless heaven.
I want to thank all of you for turning out tonight, and I especially want to thank my colleagues, our students, and Claudia's friends for participating in this event. It's been a wonderful experience, and I feel very honored to have been Claudia's friend and her colleague, and I am very moved by this event. You know, Claudia had a bunch of other incarnations before she decided to become a poet. One was a headmistress at a small town girls' school, and she got a wonderful book out of that called Figure Studies. And for a long time, she was a postwoman. She was, in fact, a rural letter carrier near Chatham, where she grew up. And, you know, I've decided to read this poem in part because I know that Claudia's favorite poet, Emily Dickinson, always referred to her poems as her letter to the world. And in some respects, the notion of being somebody who delivers mail and someone who writes a poem, and that poem is opened in a book by someone else decades later, centuries later, the two aren't that different. So I think of this poem as a kind of ars poetica, as well as a description of her life then. It's called Rural Letter Carrier. For a brief while, the 86 miles gave some illusion of travel,
the season's slow cycling part of it, the sky moving from cloud to clearing, fields turned under or crowded with corn, crows, soybeans, tobacco, snow. But the road did not change finally, not the straight stretches, nor the rain-fettered curves, the relentless echo of gravel ping, the hushing of dust, mud huss, and skunk musk. The houses went down over time, the men dying away, then the widows, and the yards of empty houses, their children, went on living in trailers with tires on the roofs. And the names of the mailboxes and the ones in the ragged graveyards were the same. Some people hung their clothes from barbed wire fences to dry. And as long as I had been driving that route, delivering her check, one old woman still hid behind the trunk of a sycamore in her yard until I drove off again. Some days, I stopped at the country store where a few bottles of soda floated like blasted fish in the drink box, where men checked deer and turkeys and brought bait, where no one knew any news but of who died. It only took my Sunday absence for a wren or sparrow to begin a nest in a mailbox forgotten open, or a hornet to finish one that I'd find hanging down like a gray wattle of venomous goiter from the throat. They said there wouldn't be any letters anymore, what with people getting news through the air and money just numbers on a screen that added up to a worse nothing, stored in a machine somewhere, all of it invisible and flying reckless, swarmless as thoughts never meant to be spoken, then spoken. I'd driven through enough lonely days to believe sometimes I passed by those hours instead, like estranged houses to which I might return some distant day, not to deliver the day's worries or ordinary temptations, but the letter addressed in a hand so far away, so familiar, it would need no other understanding, having found in me its last and only way. I'd now like to turn over our podium to our chair in the English department, Dr. Kathy Bassard, for some closing remarks.
Knowing everything I now know, if I had the chance to hire Claudia Emerson, I would do it all over again. She was a gift to us, and for the short time she was at VCU, she left a lasting impact that will live on in her poetry, in her students, in her friends, and the scholarship endowed in her name. We are each the better for having had her life brush up against our own. The organizers of this event would like to thank all of its participants, the VCU Department of English, the VCU College of Humanities and Sciences, and we thank Dean Coleman for beginning this program so ably, and for their sponsorship of the event. We also would like to thank Mary Flynn, and special thanks is due to Kent Ippolito. We're going to close this evening by watching a video of Claudia reading from her own work.
This one I call Limb Factory, the Hanger Limb Factory. There's one of them in Richmond, Virginia, where I'm about to move. And I'm interested in, I suppose, interchangeable parts and the restoration of the body in times of war and how that industry sort of kicks into another gear. It carries an epigraph from Ezekiel chapter 37. The hand of the Lord was upon me and carried me out in the spirit of the Lord and set me down in the midst of the valley, which was full of bones, and caused me to pass by them round about. And behold, there were very many in the open valley, and lo, they were very dry. And he said unto me, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered, O Lord God, thou knowest. Despite the seeming singularity of the fetal sonogram, the wonder or despair at a murky, undeniable first, an avoided or longed-for windfall last. Perhaps all of it has been like this, mass production, an assembly line, the demand a given, though more in this place, in times of war, the industry of it, a study in loss, and the argument against it, the physics and engineering of what moves, recovers, resists, and follows the body's original order, the flux and give of a gathering of dust, reproduced, piecemeal, a room for arms, legs, someone's specialty, the knee, the foot, someone's the hand. And perhaps such survival has always been part conjure, part clinical, the muscle twitch of quickening, a fashioned thing, interchangeable, abject, this remembrance, not begotten, made.